Ladies and gentlemen, boys and ghouls, to all of our non-binary friends, to everyone on the spectrum and in between, welcome to another episode of The Shudder Show. With me, as always, is my co-host,
David Marlowe.
And not with us, as always, but very special guest is the director of The Stylist, Jill Javarjazian. Did I get that correct or pretty close?
It's Gavargazian.
All right. Well, I tried.
I appreciate it.
I feel like you and Pete Buttigieg, we get along very well during interviews. I feel like that's another person that has to constantly tell people how that name is pronounced.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Fantastic. How are you doing this week? How are things on your side of the world?
Pretty awesome. We just had Halloween week and it was a freaking perfect weekend and passed out lots of candy. So it was lovely.
Awesome.
It was
great,
honestly awesome.
It's happy belated Halloween.
How was your guys' Halloween?
You know, since my wife and I, we are still renting a small apartment as we're waiting to get into our first home. So we're pretty much, we watched Cabinet of Curiosities the day before. Today was all Ted Lasso for some reason. But you know what? We went to bed happy.
There we go. Yeah, mine was super good. Yeah, we had a bunch of kids come by the house here, and then I ended up teaching at San Jose State. So that was pretty fun. So it was a pretty solid little Halloween.
Awesome.
But yeah, let's see here. But this week we are talking about the 2002 film May by director Lucky McKee. And it is one of the inspirations for your film, The Stylist. Is that true, Jill?
Yes. And yeah, it made me realize as I was writing the date down, doing a dorky like rewatch study of it last night. I'm like, oh my God, it's the 20-year anniversary. How am I that old already?
Yeah, no,
is it really the 20-year? Because what year did it
come out in?
2002.
It somehow is 2022. I don't know how this has happened.
Now, Jill, when did you first see this film?
That's what I was going to say. Is somehow, I have no idea how this, like, I didn't hear about it when it came out. Because that's the year I graduated high school. It makes, like, no sense that this wouldn't have been, like, right in my alley, or like someone would have told me about it, because I didn't see it probably till like 2012 or 13 or something, 10 years later at least.
Wow.
What about you?
This is actually my first time seeing the film. It had always been one of those ones that I saw, like, because I graduated in 99, so this was I kind of felt the same way, and I was like, how did nobody put this in my hands when I was that age?
Yeah.
And it always was one I saw on the shelves of Blockbuster. Lucky McKee was always one of those horror directors who you could always tell when you were talking to a real horror fan, because Lucky's name would come up, because he wasn't somebody who was killing it at the box office. But if you are a fan of horror, Lucky's name is really on that short list of people you should be paying attention to. And so this was my first watching go around.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and so like, and like, I didn't realize that Rian Johnson was the editor on this, and that the DP was Steve Yedlin. That the cast of this was so surprising. Like, this is maybe my favorite Anna Faris performance. I thought she was just so good, and for somebody that I'm so used to seeing in something like Scary Movie or The Hot Chicks or something like that, it was really cool to just see her like play a real proper character.
This was very early in her career, wasn't it? Was this before Scary Movie?
Oh yeah, definitely, for sure. Yeah, Scary Movie is going to be, yeah, like 2006, something like that.
Yeah, with all these actors, and then especially Jeremy Sisto, who I was a Clueless fanatic, so I just don't have any idea how this wasn't like, how I didn't know about it the second it, you know, it came out.
Wow. Okay. So Scary Movie 2000. Shit. Sorry.
Yeah.
It was before.
Wow. Yeah. It's 2000. Oh, wow. Which, wow, makes me feel even older.
Because I remember I saw this film for the first time in Chicago when I was in college. In Chicago, it was playing at the movie, the Music Box Massacre. So every Halloween, which of course this is appropriate given that every Halloween or around the Halloween season, the Music Box Theater in Chicago has a 24-hour horror film festival, and it's just they start from early black and white films. Some don't even have sound, and they usually try to have like a live organist there playing along with it. But then one of the sleeper hits for one of the times that I went was May, and I remember just never hearing about it for the longest time, but I recognized the poster because, man, the poster marketing was spectacular. That is a hell of a memorable poster. And it played, and it was everyone's favorite that year. It was just one of those crazy little sleeper hits, and almost nobody there had heard of it, or at least had just maybe in passing heard of it.
Yeah. This an acquaintance I have in the horror community, a guy named Terry Taylor. He has an awesome horror shop in Lawrence, Kansas. But I met him a million years ago, and he has May tattooed on his arm. This is before I had seen the film, and I'm like, okay, what is this movie that he has tattooed on his arm? Because he loves horror movies, and like, so that was what like my first hearing of it. Is me seeing this tattoo and be like, what the hell is this movie? Obviously something awesome.
Was it a tattoo of the poster, or was it just of the actress, Angela?
It is it is the poster with all the, like, is it like not what's around her?
Scalpels and scissors. Yeah. And scalpels.
And I realized, not that I didn't remember that this happens in the movie, but like, we don't enough bring it up around Halloween, because the film, you know, culminates on Halloween night, and it's not brought up enough when we're talking about like movies specifically to watch around this time of year, and we should.
Yeah, it is a solid Halloween film. The thing ends literally on the night of Halloween, and it's she's able to do what she does under the cover of oh sweet costume.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I love when she's dragging the cooler around, and then she passes by the zombie lady who's just like, oh, you got any cold ones in there? And she goes, yep, and just kind of keeps walking, which is just like a nice little nod. And like, that's one of the things I loved about this, and what I've loved about Lucky McKee's work is all of those little moments and beats that make things a little off, that makes things a little interesting. Like, I love the guy who comes in who's just like, my dog is missing his leg. And I can't find it. And then he like brings it back later. And she's like, you know, he's like, can you sew it back on? And she goes, I guess I'll try. And that's such a weird, unsettling moment that you just don't see in other horror movies, that I think is like, especially with, I've got to assume working at like a veterinarian's clinic, you're going to get a lot of people acting very weirdly because they're so attached to their pets, or this is so outside of their normal experience that you're going to get this. Yeah, you're going to get these odd characters or these odd reactions. And for a movie that is so much about May kind of being this interesting, attractive person that you're kind of drawn to, and then much like Jeremy Sisto, you're kind of like, ha ha, ha ha, okay, actually, I'm gonna back off here. This seems like it's not going to go terribly well. It's such... I don't know. It's why I love Lucky McKee as a director, because those are the things that I feel like a horror director really brings to a small film like this, especially also given how independent this is. He's not going to have as much restrictions. He's going to be able to make a true Lucky McKee film, and I don't like to use the term auteur, but you get really him. You can see him on screen.
Yeah, I remember. In listening to a couple of interviews with him and a few podcasts that he was on, this was, I mean, obviously, aside from being like one of his earliest films, and usually the earlier films tend to be the big passion projects for a lot of directors. But I remember this production for this happened, I want to say, pretty soon after, his girlfriend at the time had passed away from cancer. And so at the time, a lot of this was coming from a place of loneliness for him. And in fact, though, his girlfriend's name was Amy. And so, and that's who he named, her monster after. And in fact, apparently he included a lot of his ex-girlfriend's, artistic aesthetic to May. So a lot of her, like how a lot of her clothes look very, are all like handmade or have that handmade look to it. Just even down to like the way her room looks, and, you know, with the exception of all the creepy dolls, he put as much of her into this film as possible. So you really see a lot of that passion play across on this film. Like it's a genuine, it holds up so well. Like I'm surprised, even like given like it's the 90s, like early 2000s flash cuts that you see in a bunch of other movies from the 90s and early 2000s, it actually doesn't age it like it would other ones.
Well, I think a big part of that is go on, Jill.
I was going to say something about it being that personal. I actually didn't have any idea how, like, that story, the backstory with Lucky, but I felt like I was going to say, without having any real knowledge, that it feels so personal. It feels deeply personal compared to his other films, like on a level. It comes out of the film, and that's why I love it so much.
Mm-hmm. And I think I remember Lucky McKee had stated at one point that May wouldn't exist if it weren't for Amanda Plummer's character in The Fisher King. Which, have any of you, have any of you guys ever seen that one?
Yeah, yeah,
Terry Gilliam.
Yes.
Yeah, Terry Gilliam, Robin Williams, and Jeff Daniels? No, not Jeff Daniels. It's
Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges, there we go, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So, but now I want to see The Fisher King, because I'm very curious who this character is of Amanda Plummer. He's a very, in his interviews, he's very reserved. He doesn't really go into a massive amount of detail because he kind of wants audiences to decide for themselves, like what they're getting for it, like from this film, like what it means to them, what a certain moment meant to them. So I'd even love to just kind of go over kind of, I guess, like portions of this movie and kind of like what you guys got from it.
Sure. Actually, before we do that, David, do you want to give us, or Jill, either one, do you guys want to give us a brief synopsis about what May is about?
You know what, Jill? I'm gonna let you take that one. We usually like to do this. We do an off-the-cuff summarization of the movie.
I'm not the best synopsizer. I don't know what the word is.
We'll go with that.
Synopsitrician, yes. I'm not going to be good at describing this. Oh my God. What even is it about? I feel like one of you should do it.
It's all right. What is it? What are we? It's
all right. Well, okay. I would say the movie is May is a lonely girl who has a lazy eye and has always been a little socially awkward. And she, she finally meets Jeremy Sisto, who is a boy with very nice hands, and she kind of becomes fixated on them. And through her friendship with him, May starts to open up and get out there into the world a little bit more. And then as she starts to explore that world, her uniqueness and the disturbing aspects of her character start to reveal themselves through not only her actions, but also her relationship with a doll that she's had since she was a child. That sound about right?
Ken, I think you stop drilling your head oil, good sir.
All right, fantastic.
But no, this is, oh gosh, what was that? I was, because I'm trying to remember if this one started as, because this was soon after he got out of school, and I think this might have also started as a short film as well. I can't recall exactly which. Jill, The Stylist itself was started as a short film in 2016, correct?
Yes. And since the shorts really mostly just Claire, the lead character, in her salon doing her thing, but going home to what we've now call her lair after a million years, but that lair and her sitting at the vanity is like a direct visual lift from May at the end of her looking in the vanity, crying, defeated, you know, realizing that making this thing doesn't fix anything, that kind of feeling, that idea is the same idea I had it for the short. Like wearing these scalps doesn't fix it in the end. I like making sad movies, which I think is actually an interesting thing about maybe why May isn't brought up for Halloween movies, because how much as I love it, it is sad, which I love sad movies, but it's not like, yay, fun movie. Which a lot of my favorite movies are not fun movies. there are fun aspects, but it's not like, you know.
Oh, for the longest time, one of my favorite movies was What Dreams May Come. It's, oh my God. You know, so I feel you on that one, Jim.
Well, I would say one of the things with horror is I think a real good horror movie tends to be a little bit of a bummer. But the best horror movies, I feel like, really draw you in. And that's what I was so surprised about May, is like the first half an hour of this movie is really, really kind of cute and sweet. And May comes off as a little bit of an awkward weirdo, but it's not like, other than, you know, that you're watching a horror movie, so chances are things aren't going to go well. There's no real indication of where we're going with her psychosis, mm-hmm. with this, other than, I guess, the opening shot of her screaming with the bloody eye. But again, that could be, there's a lot of different ways that could end up happening with her not being necessarily the antagonist. And I think this film really plays, this is one of the few films that I really feel like they're able to make the killer somebody that you really understand and that you relate to. And then you find yourself as the movie goes on kind of being like, oh man, okay, no, hang on. She's crazy. This is bad. Oh, I feel bad for, oh no, leave the cat alone. No, what are you doing with the blind kids? Oh my God.
When we were watching this at the Music Box Massacre, there's a point where she's on the date with Adam. And at one point she says, I've never had a boyfriend before, or I've never been in a relationship before. And then someone in the audience just yells out, danger. And just the entire audience just like I feel so bad for her, just in the sense of it's kind of like the stylist. There's that part of her that is obviously what she ends up doing is terrible and wrong, but it's a real impressive thing that Lucky McKee does in getting everyone to sympathize with May so much, even when it comes down to like, oh my God, this girl is so awkward. May, you poor sweet thing. I need you to say something, please, for the love of God, just ask you a question. just answer the, oh my God, please say something.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite things about the film, that it's truly just like a drama and a psycho thriller until the very last part of the movie, which is hard to do. and hard to get the horror fans to go along with it, you know, like the real hardcore. But it's like, when you have a character that is that, has that much depth, it's like, you know, she just brings you in, and we're along for the ride, whatever the hell she's going to do.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, one of the things that I found kind of reflected in from the stylist in this was just like, I found myself rooting in the stylist for her to like make friends with the coffee shop girl. And I was like, oh no, this will be great. Like, this will kind of open you up and things will be fine. And then again, much like this, you're like, oh no, this is not gonna end well. No, leave. Oh, come on. But the fact that you're able to make them feel that way is, yeah, a testament to both films.
And I think what's so interesting too, is that her as the type of awkward that she is, or the type, or like, cause she's almost like a weird form of almost like a female incel, in the sense of like, nobody, like it was like the phrase mm-hmm. that she said, like, so many nice parts, no nice holes. And it's the idea that because of something that, like, and let's face it, that is kind of inherently, not necessarily, I don't want to say the word like wrong with her, but like she just hasn't been able to develop the way that other people do. And because of that, she's just not socially equipped for many situations. And so, I think you find the same likeness in a lot of male incels online, except in her particular area, like, she doesn't approach it with anger. And I think that's based solely on, like, how her mother raised her. She's just more of a freezes in place and doesn't really know what to do with it until everything just bottles up and explodes in this just massive violent ending. And it's just such and I think you would see this, you would say the same for your lead in The Stylist. It's just, there is something going on in there that took place because of either the way that she was raised or some previous trauma in her life or not feeling accepted, that just culminates in unfortunately very toxic, violent behavior.
I love the dark humor in moments like you said, when she says, there's only good parts, not any good holes. And like the person she's speaking to thinks like, this is a theater, you know, like some philosophical idea. And she's like, no, literally I'm trying to make a doll, the perfect human at home. I love fucked up humor like that, like only the audience understands what's going on because
I mean, when she Lysols the cat is one of those.
Yes.
Just such a weird, awkward, funny, like there's no audience. Especially a horror audience. I've got to assume that moment just slays.
Here's a movie that kills an animal that we haven't, you know, sacrificed to the god.
Yeah.
Part is hard. It's like, oh my god, please don't throw it at the fucking cat.
Oh my
R.I.P.
god.
R.I.P. cat.
I know. All right. But you know, you're right. It's one of those few occasions where the lead character ends up killing an animal or a pet, and you don't immediately go, oh, well, this person is no longer a person to me. They need to die. And I'm so sorry.
I almost think I kind of block it out from some sort of, because every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, it's so horrible. And then be like, she didn't do that.
Well, they do because,
job. I sympathize with her so much.
Well, and they're also smart in the fact that, like, a lot of the truly bloody or horrible moments are played off screen, whether it's the moment that the cat gets hit with that ashtray or when she does her eye trauma at the very end. It is not framed right here like you'd see in most horror movies that you'd see, you know, where they're really getting excited about the wetness of the film. This movie is, you know, other than the two girls dying at the end, not really that wet of a film. It's a little gross. It's a little squishy. I mean, I would say probably the most disturbing part, at least for me, is when she's telling the story about the dog and the searchers that get ripped. And she's just talking about, you know, and she's just like, she's just kind of laughing and smiling, and you're just like, oh God, you know. And
that part is great.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Hot. Yeah, just heebie-jeebies.
It's so interesting because in college, like there were a couple of people in a few of my classes, a couple of girls that actually may reminded me of like not necessarily to that degree, but in the sense that just kind of seems supremely unaware of maybe the social snafu that they have just committed. But just like misinterpreting the moment that they're in and just being like he's like cool, gross me out. She takes that as an actual challenge and think, you know, they both like he thinks it's a fun game. He thinks he's being cute and charming and whatever. And it's just every time he thinks of like, oh no, like she doesn't know how weird I am. And then she just continues to top him and his weirdness to the point where finally he's like, she's like, but you like weird. He's like, not that weird. And it's that I felt so bad for her, even though like literally she just like injured his lip in this. It was just so well done.
Well, on the commentary, they let's see here. Where was I going?
Commentary.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, on the commentary, they actually mention Dario Argento is one of like the primary, primarily like one of Lucky McKee's favorite movies, and I think this is so movie because this is a movie that reminds me so much of Argento. But again, like when you get a lot of the gory moments, you don't get that. that Italian giallo bloodbath that you normally get. You don't get like the red blood. You don't get the bathing in the gore that you would normally associate with that. But like, I don't know, for me, like it's the tone, it's the creepiness, it's all of those little moments that really add up to something that that I thought was very giallo-esque, which is something I wanted to bring up to you, Jill, because I kind of got a lot of that same vibe from the stylist and like a lot of the great colorful cinematography. But again, your film is not a wet movie. It's definitely got gore in it, but it's not, it's not Suspiria. It's not Deep Red or one of that. So like I wanted
Or
to ask you about,
Terrifier
well, yeah, so I wanted to ask you about
2.
like, are you a giallo fan? Was that something that was I crazy? Was that something that you drew for the stylist?
It's weird. I didn't grow up seeing a lot of that stuff, so I didn't see a lot of giallo until I was much older. So I feel like instinctually it didn't. Visually, it did when we kind of got further into developing certain things. And I realize a lot of the filmmakers I'm inspired by were definitely inspired. So it's like a chain of like a family tree of being inspired by giallo, essentially. Yeah, I love those simple awkward moments. And then like you're saying, like when the I love, he says, I love gross and I love weird. And yeah, she takes that very literally. And I love those like misunderstandings between like people on just like totally different planes that have, they don't have any idea what the other one's really saying. Like those communication breakdowns. That's the magic of this film. And but why I love like psychologically based horror like this so much.
I was gonna say the other thing I was actually thinking is it's really interesting that Jeremy Sisto is almost playing the girlfriend character in this. Like in so many other movies, their entire dynamic would be switched. There would be the killer guy who's all about weird, creepy, gross stuff, and he's like really pushing things too far with the girl. And in this, it's completely flipped. Or just in the fact that like I love that Anna Faris is a horny lesbian. Like, because you just never see that. It is just a it like a, it's just a woman who likes sex and happens to be
Do you want to
gay.
watch me
It's not a big
file?
deal. Yeah, and but it's not,
It's
it's not over
definitely
the
over the
top.
top.
Yeah,
Oh,
but it's
say I
not
got you.
gratuitous. I love how
Well,
over
but
the
it's not
top she is in this
gratuitous, you know
film.
what I mean? Like it'd be so easy to make that character just a slutty character, and there's so much fun. Like she's just a sex positive character, not just a big slutty character, because she's not trying to sleep with everything. No, she likes girls and she likes May and she likes she likes the girl that she meets, but it's not the movie never judges her for it. It's just like this is who she is. It's totally fine, and like that's just so rare, especially for a movie. God help us, that's 20 years old. Because yeah, there's a lot of movies that I watch from when I was a graduating high school that are now like, ooh, this is pretty problematic. This doesn't, this doesn't really hold up anymore.
Well, you have films like The Craft, and then you have Ginger Snaps that are very LGBTQ friendly, or like or steer more towards like the lesbian side of things. Whereas, and I have a lot of friends now who identify as bisexual, and it's become like one of the struggles that they have is that it's not they feel like they're not taken as seriously as say like their lesbian or gay counterparts. And so it is really refreshing to see a very healthy portrayal. I don't know if healthy is the right word to use, but a very kind of straightforward portrayal of bisexuality and what it means to explore like one's interest in different sexes and just how it is this spectrum.
Well, I think that like the all you need to do is talk about the slutty character who immediately takes off his top and then asks for ice for his nipples is James Duvall. And is not
Best quote of the
one of the
movie.
female characters. You know what I mean? Like I could see, some producer being like, "Well, look, can we just switch it? It'll really help with our foreign distribution if we make it more female nudity." And the answer is absolutely not. No, we're gonna completely
That's not
flip
the
the
kind of
script
movie
here.
he's making.
Yeah, exactly. Which,
You know,
yeah, James Duvall with the wild, crazy hair. Apparently, they put wires in his hair and they used eggs in order to stick it up, which was just, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen like a
I was going to say, like,
full-on punk hairstyle.
What was his reasoning behind that hair choice?
I think he's just a punk. I think he's just like an SLC punk style of just like that was, you know, that I mean, that's just the style, I guess.
God, it's just like, does he do that hair like every day that he wakes up in the morning? I just feel like that's just that hair just looks like a chore.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's outrageous. It is. To, yeah.
Punk rock, like, I've always thought that was interesting about the punk rock culture. I am a hairstylist for real.
I mean, if anyone were to comment on this.
That culture is so, like, you know, I don't give a fuck, like, anti-everything, conformity, blah, 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 blah. But, like, the hair has to be right. Everything has to be all a certain way. So I'm like, it's its own version of conformity that I find very hypocritical and funny. But I bet they didn't realize, like, James's hair is probably thick as hell. I'm sure it was so hard to get it to, like, style that way. I can't even imagine.
What's the craziest haircut you've ever had to give?
The craziest? I don't know. I mean, I've done a lot of wacky mullets. I always have fun doing that stuff, though.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
So, I got to say, like, I love the fact that you still work as a stylist. Like, I really admire that you're the juggling of like the two passions that you've been doing. Like, it's just been, and also and it shows on the stylist. It really shows that you know exactly what you're talking about. Like when portraying the lead character, that it's just, I don't know. I always thought that was a little aspect of the stylist that I really, really enjoyed, was that it did feel like a movie that was made by somebody who actually cut hair for a living.
That was a big part of why I decided I should do it. When I thought of how is there not a movie about a hairstylist that kills people other than Sweeney Todd, like a horror version of that. And, so I was like, well, I think I should do it. Like, this is all before the short film. But I mean, and then I think a lot of people have a misconception once you've made a film that you're making money making movies. All of us mostly still have full-time jobs. Until you're like making Marvel movies, it's a struggle. But I mean, it's art, so I feel like it kind of has to be.
Yeah.
So one of the things actually I wanted to ask you, Jill, is so one of the suggestions I make to other fellow filmmakers out there is if you're going to be making your independent film, your short film, you're trying to break out there, you shouldn't start by saying like writing your script with like, ooh, I've got an idea for the interior of a submarine movie. And it's like, well, unless you have access to a submarine, you probably shouldn't start there. And I know your background is a hairstylist. I've got to assume, and I know that you shot, in your hometown and such. I was curious, like, what aspects of the stylist were you like, okay, I have access to this. I know I can get all of this, so we can back into making the movie and putting like all of that money that I know you raised through Kickstarter, making sure all of that money goes on screen and not going to somebody's manager or going to an espresso cart for everybody. It's, you know, or paying for some crazy location. It's like, no, I know I can get the hair salon cheap, so we're going to start there and then we can back into what we have. And then using your resources effectively, which I think especially for all of us young filmmakers or any filmmaker trying to break in, showing that you can make $1 look like 10 is the is one of your most valuable skills.
That's exactly it. And I learned like that thinking from reading Robert Rodriguez's book back when I first started, you know, his Rebel Without a Crew. And just the idea of writing around, you know, when you're starting off and you don't have $1 million at your disposal, to up your production value with things or locations or props or whatever it might be. Like, think of what do you have access to? And I really understood how a location makes your film look like from here to like here versus like, you know, a white walled apartment versus like some cool loft with brick walls, just things like that. I picked that up, I feel like, early, and it was largely from that advice. It made me realize, like, you know, we don't have the money to really build a whole set or design a room that's all pretty basic. If you get if your location is cool or like visually interesting, whatever that means, is it's just going to make your film look crazy. So that's always been a focus of mine with all the shorts. And so when that was a huge thing, when the stylist thing came about in my head, I'm like, well, first, how does this not exist? Just the hairstylist thing. And then I'm like, well, I have the knowledge of being a hairstylist plus the location connections. And it just seemed like, so I always kind of reverse engineered projects like that, like around things, places, like they said, the write what you know thing. Like, what do you, and I think that's true. Like all the stuff that really shines out is stuff that's personal. Like we're all trying to make like the coolest, craziest, scariest movie. But what really resonates with people is like why May's resonating with us so much, because it was so personal for him. It sounds like, I'm not speaking for Lucky McKee. I've had the chance to like meet him and I was just like, I just said like two words probably. I'm just like, hi, I love your film. Had he seen The Stylist? I have to brag and like tweeted about it. And I was always so worried. I was like, will he be upset? Because it's so clear how inspired I am by the film.
And well, it's so funny because when I saw, I kept saying like the second that May pops up on Shudder, like that's just going to be the next film that we do. And so, and then we did our episode on The Stylist and come to realize that you'd gotten a lot of your influence from May. And the second that it popped up, the first thing I had to do was just like Instagram story it out. I'm like, just shoot my shot and be like, Hey, Jill, do you want to talk about this cool movie with us? And it's
always.
Just
always.
That is the great thing about the horror community too, is it's always been such an open community. And I imagine that like your interactions with your fans and with like your fellow horror members, that it must be wonderful to get to like interact with these people like almost every day.
It is awesome. And yeah, the community is so tight. It's like even all over the whole world, I feel like. And that's part of one of my favorite things of going to any film festivals, is I feel like once you kind of go to a few, there's this like tribe of people. It's like summer camp. No matter which city or even country you go to, you'll probably run into a dozen people you've seen in another one. And yeah, I love it. And it's like all of this is how our films grow. And I feel like that's why there's so many cult classics in this genre. It's like, because we're all so obsessed with all of it and we just keep talking about it, which I love. 20 years later, here we are talking about May.
Yeah. Are there any other movies that you're surprised have like reached cult status? Like one that I find myself surprised by is 13 Ghosts. That one actually like is starting to develop a real like heavy cult following.
Yeah, House of Wax has got the same kind of like, actually, pretty good. Because I know when it came out, everyone's like, oh yeah, I know when it came out, everyone's like, oh, Paris Hilton's in this. This is terrible. And now I'm seeing lots of like, it's actually pretty good. And
actually, that Friday the 13th remake ain't half bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, I think, is a great example of like a, no, that's the second best Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie for me.
Now that we've had five more remakes, we have a different perspective.
Yeah.
one that I'm, that I have always been praying keeps building is Idle Hands. I'm a personal Psycho fan for. And that needs to be like major cult status at this point. Like, come people.
No, that was actually, that was so funny. That was one of the movies for me that really made me realize like your mood when you go see a movie will completely change your opinion of it. Because when I first saw it, I got forced to go see it with a girl I was dating at the time, right at the end of our relationship. And I remember being like, this is terrible. I did not like this. And then like a year and a half later, I ended up seeing this and I was like, I was in a bad mood. This movie is so much fun and so interesting. And yeah, it's, I definitely own it. I think you and I actually even like interacted for the first time on Twitter because you did a photo shoot, I want to say, with Devin Sawa. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, wait, I aren't you from that? Okay, that's cool. But yeah, no, I also have love for Idle Hands. Speaking of cool other independent film stuff, Jill, any advice you have for any of our, because a lot of our fans are filmmakers themselves. And I mean, I love the, you have such a great story of you got to make the short film and then you got to make the movie and it was well accepted and you got into festivals and now you've got this amazing, beautiful DVD and Blu-ray that's out. What advice, anything to tell our filmmakers at home about what you've learned along the way?
Oh my gosh. I could write a book, and I've thought about maybe I should write a book about this experience. But I feel like kind of what you said, the last question I answered that made me like really writing, if you're not sure like what you want to make yet, it's really about, you know, trying to make something personal, not trying to make what you think people want you to make. Because ultimately what connects with people is when you make something that means a lot to you. Like I feel like we can just feel it even when we don't know it. But I think a big part of like starting, for instance, and I'm telling myself this again, I think, because it's been almost 3 years since we shot The Stylist, and now I haven't directed anything since. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to make another movie to remind myself that I can do this. Like before you start any of this stuff, it seems impossible, but it's really just like starting it and breaking it down step by step, because like anyone can do anything if you make lists and steps, and that's
if The Dentist 2 has proven anything, is that I think The Stylist could easily have a sequel.
That era of slashers is totally also as inspiration. I was like, how does this not already exist in that time? Like the Dentist, the Landlady, like there was Dr. Giggles, which is great. Sad it never got a sequel. Yeah.
Because you're fine. Because the plot of Dentist 2, doesn't he just move to another town and nobody questions his background or anything? And he's able just to get a practice?
It has the best tagline.
I haven't seen it.
The Dentist 2, brace yourself. Which is just...
Oh my God.
Like, just a, like somebody in the advertising department was like, and I'm done for the day and I'm going home.
I will take that check now. Thank you very much.
One from the era I didn't see was till recently was The Stepfather, which is like totally awesome. And I'm like, I would have been inspired by this had I known it exists. It's fucking great. It's like has that psychological and horror, and it's funny and weird.
Is that with what's his face from Lost?
I don't know.
I don't know well enough. People are Lost.
Oh gosh. I mean the old man, the bald old man from Lost.
John Locke. Yeah.
Yes,
Terry,
thank you.
Terry something. Yes.
Is he the stepfather?
Terry O'Quinn. There we go.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, Terry O'Quinn is his name. All right, so David, while you look that up for us, Jill, actually something that I think you'd be uniquely to be able to talk about. So, your movie got finished right before the pandemic. And then you finish the movie and it gets released, it gets into film festivals, but we're in the pandemic. And now, post-pandemic, as they say, I assume the movie is starting to play in more film festivals where you get to go and you get to interact with an audience in the more traditional fashion. Can you just talk a little bit about what it was like getting to do the festival circuit both online and then, I mean, obviously, it's better to get to see it with an audience in the theater. But yeah, I was just curious, like what that experience was like, just because that's something so unique that I think you're one of the few people can actually talk to about.
Yeah, it was, I try to stay positive, but it was definitely a bummer in the sense of like, you know, that's like the big celebration at the end of the long road of struggling to make this thing. To really hear responses in real time is like all the magic. But then we premiered virtually at Fantastic Fest, which was freaking incredible. The positive was that anyone versus us just being accessible to like the people in Texas, it was the whole, anyone at home could watch it. So it was cool to like experience, at least there were still a lot of like engagement. It didn't feel like we were just alone watching it. It was like, get on Twitter right after and see everyone's responses. And then I could do that with any, you know, I was like obsessively following festival hashtags to see what people were saying in other countries, like translating tweet. What the hell does this say? Some scary, mostly positive. We always had a great attitude about anything people would say negative. I'm like, okay, you know that some of that has to exist. But I don't know, it was interesting because also we were doing the virtual ones, we had a few drive-in screening. So it was
That's
even
cool.
like it was nice to have a couple like in person-ish, especially to do them. They were in October of 2020 that we got to do a couple. And then yes, it's crazy. I think this is special to our circumstance, even though like the film was out in so many VOD, Blu-ray, whatever, we're still getting festival screenings, and that's really because we didn't have that experience before. A lot of festivals wouldn't play anything that, you know, this old, as weird as that sounds to say, but that isn't like fresh, like brand new. So, and I'm so appreciative when any entity reaches out and wants to screen it. I'm like reaching out to our distributor. Please tell me, like, can we say yes to this? And they are always, Arrow has been incredible to work with. And so we're still scheduling stuff. I might talking to Alamo about kind of going to multiple Alamo Draft House to show it more.
Yes. Awesome.
So I'm like, anywhere that'll show it, we got like a film of this size, we got to keep championing it as much as we can.
I mean,
Which,
if you can get a screening over at the Music Box Massacre around the next Halloween season, like you got a
we were
solid
part of,
audience of people.
it would be so awesome. We were part of their event they did in 2020, which was at a drive-in. So it was like they
Oh,
were doing
okay.
like a drive-in thing like every night for like a certain amount of nights. And we screened a few nights before Halloween, so it was cool. But yeah, I'd love to do. I've heard a lot about that marathon. It's
It's
infamous at this point.
oh, it is. I mean, and it is, because like half the theater is pretty much gone by the time like the 24, like if you've been able to stay for like the whole 24 hours, it's a little badge of honor you groggily walk out with. But like I remember, like, and some of my favorite movies in horror have been seen there, and it's just I just have nothing but fond memories there. I think actually I literally was able to get an original doodle from Clive Barker, which is now a tattoo on my back.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Sticker. So yeah, like I will happily cheer you on if you're able to get a spot there for sure. Ken, do we want to start kind of like, I guess, wrapping May up with maybe like one or two more like just things that we enjoyed about the film or?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a couple of fun facts I found out on the commentary track that I thought were fun. So the dead stuffed cats from the movie were provided from the Adam Sandler movie Mr. Deeds. They were left over from that. So we have Adam Sandler to thank for those, I guess. I want to say I personally love the choice of giving Jeremy Sisto little weird race car underpants. Like that's
Oh,
such a
yeah.
unique choice. That I'm not like I have it's one of those like I have questions, but also it's perfect, no notes. And I also personally, as somebody who used to smoke, the bad smoking from May, as somebody who's never smoked before and is trying to be cool and just perfect performance of someone who's like, no, this is great. I'm loving this. This is
My
yeah, no, J Jeremy loves it. Yeah, those hands, look at this. Look at me.
wife watched this with me for the first time, and the one thing that she could not get over was May's use of her hands and how her fingers were always constantly splayed apart. It was just like that level of awkward for her, just like was so cringy. She's like, why can't she just close her, just close them, please? And it like every so every like 10 minutes she goes, her fucking hands, oh my God. But it's, oh my God, it's which, oh, separate thing, by the way, yes, it was Terry O'Quinn.
Yes,
Yes.
got the name right.
Sweet. Very good at faces, kind of. But no, Ken, I'm curious on your opinion of the sound design in this, because I thought that this was something that really stuck out.
Yeah, there's both the sound design and the editing are really great. The use of the cracking glass throughout all of her the tension in the scenes. The way that Rian Johnson is able to use what you were talking about with that early, with that kind of like fast cut pacing that you see most filmmakers end up just using that for style for a moment to be like, ah, things are getting crazy, so we're gonna cut a bunch. This was really much more used to show her psychological state and where she was, and the cutting back to her in the moments where she's clearly kind of disassociating or kind of blanking out when she's doing the violent moments where she's going to her, wherever she's going in her state. Like the fact that they were using all of these stylistic elements to really get into her psychology is something that I see, they actually mentioned, was also very inspired by Taxi Driver. There's the moment where she's on the phone with her back, where she's trying to talk to Jeremy, and you're just like, and she just doesn't understand that she was so weird on the date. And that's just like with Travis Bickle when he goes on to the porno theater with the girl, and he just doesn't understand why what he did was so weird. And then they go from the back of him when he's on the phone and they just dolly over to the doll, which is like the exact same shot from Taxi Driver when they dolly from Travis Bickle over to the empty hallway. And a lot of people, again, would use that for pure stylistics just to make it cool. And Lucky and Rian used it to just tell the story.
Wow. I don't have this. You commenting on the cracking of the, you know, the doll case that she's in is something that is so subtle and yeah, so effective throughout the film. I just love how the doll just mirrors her, and it's just such a simple thing that is so unnerving. And yeah, this whole film is just full of these moments, and why I say it's, I almost feel bad saying it's not a fun film because I love it so much. And yeah, there's a lot of fun moments. But yeah, these moments that are just so uncomfortable that it's just painful to watch it. And yeah, you want to like save her from them. It's like, that's powerful. It's like we care about her that much.
You just want to pull her off to the side and like do some like side coaching with her. Be like, okay, let me explain to you like the aspects of conversation and back and forth.
And when I, when we were developing the feature for The Stylist and I wasn't sure where to go, and I could only think of a couple of films that felt similar in the sense of like they're from the perspective of the quote, like bad, crazy person, this one and Maniac, and both do the flashback thing to give us understanding, and that I was trying so hard to not do that. We wrote a version that was like that. And it was interesting to me that these are May and Maniac, very different movies. But like to me, I realized like, oh, they're very similar characters, and it, from a psychological place, not what they're doing. But it was interesting to me how like narratively they were structured similar, and we got these moments with their mothers who were both. It's, and I realized so many of these characters and a lot that influenced Claire, like, they all have this similar thing with an abusive mother and trauma from that, never developing socially. And it's like this trickle in horror of all these characters that are very similar.
Well, actually, just piggybacking on that right before we kind of wrap up here, Carrie is actually something that I thought of a bunch with The Stylist as well. I mean, not just in the use of like split screens and stuff, but exactly what you were talking about with a socially awkward character that you kind of feel for, who acts a little weird, and then also the trauma from her mother and such. Yeah, would you just talk to us a little bit about Brian De Palma?
Yeah, Carrie is another one for sure. And I even go back to like, even say Psycho, or to me, Leatherface feels like he's in this world too. But yeah, Carrie and all these films have these structures of, yeah, like this person slowly, this is this downward spiral to this like amazing, horrific horror ending, third act. And it wasn't actually till I read a book, Kayla Janice's House of Psychotic Women, which you guys should read if you have not. It's like horror, the greatest horror book ever. It's specifically about, it's her autobiography mixed with focus on female neurosis and horror and exploitation. So it's all about films like May and Carrie and all this.
Awesome.
Okay. And I learned about all these films in there I hadn't seen before. Like I watched Sisters by De Palma for the first time in that exploration, but it was a sequence in there that made me of split screen that made me realize, I was like, oh, there'd be a perfect moment in the stylus to use split screen. It's almost as if we wrote it that way. And it should be, it was really written to be just back-to-back scenes. And then realize his, then turn to Carrie more. There's a big influence, a scene we were influenced by Carrie when she goes to kill me, spoiler alert, in my film was a very Carrie, kind of the aesthetic. And I envisioned Claire's mental state being similar to post-prom where Carrie is walking to kill me. And even her neck, the negligee she's wearing looks like her prom dress. But so there's all kinds of great little things like that. I'm going to spiral out of control here now.
Oh no. We do that constantly on this podcast. I'm curious, like what was your process with Nahara Tansen? Like, because her performance as Claire was absolutely spectacular. I'm just curious, like what kind of collaboration went into putting that on screen?
She's, I mean, I feel like I barely can take any credit for just how talented she freaking is. Cause with the short film, we only knew each other very little at the time and had like barely any time to prepare for that. But, when she brought her to life, then I was like, just head over heels for like her performance. And I was like, we found like the dream person to be this character. But then with the feature, we had this benefit of like having made the short, and then she was already part of this thing with us, you know, before we even wrote the feature. And so she was reading like all kinds of drafts of the feature and was like a part of, you know, helping essentially develop the character. And so she's so ingrained into it, like for years has been thinking about her now before we made the feature. And then when it came down to actually doing it, she was like working with a mannequin head at home, because I wanted her like mannerisms with hair to be as like natural as it could be. And that aside from like the emotional part of the character, because her character is so quiet and like she has to express so much without talking most of the film. And that's just, I don't know how she does that, but she took this role very seriously. I mean, like playing with hair for 6 months, cutting her friend's hair, journaling as the character. Like we worked on her background together. She taught me that she would specifically make like very detailed memories for characters, not just like a general background, but like specific moments, kind of how we will remember little things from our lives, but not like everything. And so I did that a few moments like that. And she's taught me a lot, honestly, from her perspective, how to build the background. And so, yeah, I feel like so much, it's so deep because she's just been, we're the positive of not getting to make it soon. The film, we wanted to make it a lot sooner had we had $1 million laying around. But all of us that made the short pretty much made the feature. So it was like, we all got to like marinate in this idea for so long. That was a benefit in the long run, for sure.
And I mean, you see every dollar on screen, like, and I think that's kind of the beauty of a low budget film compared to a massive studio film, where, you know, like the credit roll is just about like, is about half the length of the film itself. It's, I think you see a lot more creativity in a lower budget film in just kind of having to get the lengths to which the director and the filmmakers go to get the shot that they need, compared to like a director who literally can just throw money at the problem. Like, it's like, I think the stylist really stands out in that respect. And I think you definitely have plenty to be proud of in that particular department.
Thank you very much. Yeah. The main team, like our cinematographer, Robert Stern, and production designer, and Najara, between us coming from the short, it's even the same editor, composer. We really, it was all so much passion poured into this thing. And I just feel like I can get emotional about it because I feel so fortunate that anyone else cared about it as much as I want. You know, I hope they would to help to make the damn thing, because it's all like, those are the talented people. I just told them what I hoped it would do. I don't know any of the technical parts of it.
All right. Well, Jill, as we're wrapping up here, where can the good people at home find you? Know, like, do you have any plugs to plug, any upcoming projects? Where can they find you on the socials? Anything that you want to share with the people at home?
Yeah. You can find me at Jill Six all over the place and follow the film at Stylist Film. But the one thing I can plug, I mean, I'm working on writing and things like that, but my collaborator, John Pata, he edited The Stylist. He is also a writer director, and I'm like helping produce his new feature called Black Mold, which we shot in March. And I actually did hair on the film too, which is funny because I've done hair for almost 20 years in a salon, but never on a movie set, like as the hair on the movie. So it was cool to see the film, the whole production from that angle, and to work. It was almost all the same team from The Stylist, so it was like a reunion. So it's a psychological thriller meets horror as well, and I'm really proud. I can't wait for it to. We're hoping it'll start playing next year at festivals.
Awesome.
I've got to bug him for the latest cut. It's been a minute since I watched it.
and Jill, before we kind of get on to like our plugs and everything, Jill, I kind of wanted to ask, I meant to ask you about this earlier. So you do a thing, like you do an annual festival called the Slaughter Movie House. I was reading in your bio something about it, and I was just kind of curious what that is and kind of what goes into it.
It actually, it's about to come back. It was before the pandemic began, it was a monthly thing. It was the first Monday of every month we showed. It was just like a one night screening. We'd show an independent horror, and then it kind of spun off a lot of weird some science fiction, some just super wacky weird crap that you don't even know where to put it in the genre. And when I say that, I'm saying with love, not calling it crap. I'm sorry. Like just the weirdest stuff, you're like, well, this is weird and freaky and maybe if upsetting, let's play this. So we were doing that for almost, we started in 2012. Oh my god, what's going on? The time is flying.
What is life?
And so yeah, the pandemic stopped it suddenly, and it's coming back in a few weeks here this month in November. We do it at Screenland Armor. It used to be a free thing because we would show like really small films, just trying to get them out there like without distribution, but it'll be all different kinds of stuff. My friend Stacy, who runs Etheria Film Night, like the big female focused genre fest in LA, she's helping program it now. So I can't believe it's coming back after all this time. I didn't know if we would bring it back after the pandemic. I was like,
that's amazing. I'm so happy for you.
It's exciting. It's just been a cool, I mean, that's what got me making films, honestly, was showing all these indie films, and that's what honestly made me realize was I went to a horror convention before I started that and met some filmmakers and saw their work, and I was just like, that's when I realized that like real people made movies, not just like famous rich people, like normal people did too. Like I never had this light bulb go off in my head. And so I was like, oh wow, I need to be a part of this world, because I made silly stuff as a kid and like was always creative, but never thought that was something I could take seriously ever till I saw it, someone else do it.
Very nice. All right, well, David, if you you want to give us our pluggables for where they can find you and your general musings.
Oh, absolutely. Well, everyone, I run our Instagram page at Shudder_show, where you can catch all of our announcements for the new episodes that we'll have coming up, including all the funny little horror-themed memes that kind of makes people's lives a little bit lighter day-to-day. And then you can follow me at _DW Marlowe, where I get up to my regular musings, woodworking projects, and occasional fun times with my dog and wife. But Ken, good sir, what about you? Where can the fine people find you?
They can find me on all the socials at Ken Stachnik, KenStachnik. You can find us on Twitter at Shudder_show. You can email us shuddershow@gmail.com. And next week we'll be reviewing Deadstream, which is a Shudder exclusive, which is supposed to be like found footage Evil Dead. And we are super excited to check it out. Other than that, the only thing we have left to say is good night, good luck. And to everyone, make sure to go fuck yourselves. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Jill, so much.